speaking of WMCA, I know Lee Gray went to work there. I guess he worked for you at KLO, too?
Right. I had known Lee for a long time. Lee and I had worked together at WOKY in Milwaukee back in the 60s. Back in 60, I should say. And then I went to Albany, New York as a program director and hired him to be PD. I say WKLO was my first PD job. It was my first real PD job. I had had the title once before. And I hired Lee, and he came up and worked in Albany, and then he replaced me when I left. And he was a very good program director. And he went to Cleveland, had a nervous breakdown, and I needed an evening disc jockey, and I hired Lee to come in. He worked his way back up from being sort of a nervous wreck into being a very strong disc jockey and personality, and then I hired him in New York, and then he came back to Louisville a couple of times. Lee was an ornery cuss. He was about the worst guy I ever knew. When I first met him, he said, "You know, Mitch, when I was 5 years old, my dad went off to the oil fields of Oklahoma. My mother went off to work in the restaurants or the cafes of the oil fields of Oklahoma. My dad went to South America to the oil fields, and I went to hell." And that was sort of him. Sometime while he was working in Louisville in the 70s, I believe it was, early 70s, he became a very devout Christian. Totally changed his life, worked in Christian radio the rest of his life, mostly in Houston. And I attended his funeral about 10 years ago, and there was the largest Baptist church in Houston. It was like a Beatles concert. It was standing room only, and they had to hold the funeral home open 2 hours after they were supposed to close and still had to cut the traffic off 2 blocks away the night before the funeral, people wanting to come and pay their final respects to Lee Gray. I dare say that at about 1964, 65, nobody, including myself, would have attended his funeral. He had a terrible first half of his life and a fabulous last half of his life. First guy I hired after Chuck Browning was Johnny Randolph, who did evenings. And then we parted company after about a year, and he was replaced by Bill Hennis, who has had quite a career. And then Bill took a job as program director in New Haven, Connecticut, and I hired Lee to replace Bill Hennis. So our evening guys were all stars. You know, Randolph, Hennis, and Lee Gray.
Tell us about Johnny Randolph. When you were working with Johnny Randolph, and then knowing what you know now about Randolph and his success at Wacky in later years, were you surprised? Did you see any of that programming genius or programming talent in Johnny when he was there at KLO?
Johnny was a fanatical radio guy, and he was good. He worked hard. He had a great deal of initiative. You know, he was a fanatic, and we spent a lot of time together talking radio. I did something with Johnny that I didn't do very often. I actually became kind of friendly with him, kind of like friends. I'd been in the military, and you know, it was one of those things that you always had that layer of separation between ranks. But with Randolph, we became pretty close. Randolph was good. He had a wife, unfortunately, who thought she knew more about programming than I did, and I would talk to Johnny about doing something, and then she would advise him to do something else, and unfortunately, he oftentimes would follow her lead rather than mine. His wife would come to the station at night and would bring their dog, and the dog would piddle on the beautiful blue carpeting. He would get warned, and finally, the dog dumped in front of Ernie's office door, and that was, unfortunately, the end of Johnny Randolph. It had nothing to do with his air work. It had to do with other things, and it was the hardest thing that I ever did was having to terminate Johnny Randolph, because I liked him, and I respected his work, but we just didn't have the control that we needed over him as an employer, an employee. His wife had the control over him.
And for the record, Johnny is no longer married to that woman.
That's right.
What about Ken Douglas, the English disc jockey? Tell us about him.
I was sitting in the studio, the showcase studio window at 307 West Walnut one day, and there are a number of times, and I'd see this fellow walk from a clothing store in the corner up about half a block, almost in front of the radio station. He would always wave. He was taking clothes to be altered at a haberdashery, and I would wave at him, and he'd wave at me. And one day, Bill Crisp was in the room with me. And I said, "Bill, who is that?" And he said, "That's Ken Douglas. He's an English guy from England." And I said, "English?" Kind of rang a bell. And I said, "Next time you talk to him, why don't you listen and see what kind of accent he has?" And he came back the next day and said, I had lunch with this Ken Douglas, and he has quite an accent. He's an interesting fellow, by the way. So we set up at a time to go have lunch. Turns out he was a vagabond. He traveled around the world working on cruise ships. And on cruise ships, he would get acquainted with wealthy people, and they would invite him to dinner and invite him to come stay with him. He was like the man who came to dinner. He would take him up on it. And he had been on a cruise ship. He was a masseuse or something, and he met one of the people who ran either one of the cigarette companies or one of the liquor companies there in Louisville, had a beautiful big old mansion out in the ritzy part of town. And Ken came to town and was staying there, got a job. He was at a Christmas party. And the guy who owned the haberdashery hired him to come to work for him, and I saw him. He was a handsome guy. We had lunch. Turns out he had seen the Beatles in Liverpool before they were big. He had a good accent and a line of BS. So I asked him if he'd like to come on the radio and talk about his knowledge of the Beatles and Beatle music and English music and all, and he did as a guest on the evening show, and it worked out real good. On February 1st, 1965, I put him on regularly. He was on with a fellow named Jack Gallo, and Gallo really couldn't handle it after a while. He became jealous of Ken because Ken was getting more attention than Jack was, so Jack left the radio station. That's when I brought Johnny Randolph in to do the evenings, but I put Ken on a separate little 45, 50-minute show from, I think, 6:10. We had a racing program from 6 to 6:10, and then Ken was on from 6:10 to 7. And then we got him on the Beatle concert in 65, and we got him, I think, again in 66, he traveled with him. And he just played Beatle music and English music and talked English. He was about to lose his accent one time, so he went home for a few weeks to get his accent back. And he was one of the biggest things ever in Louisville. He was the guy who got us started. He came on in 65. He got us a lot of attention. And then Bill Bailey is the guy who made us. He was the magic that made us. We had great radio personalities who were professional personalities, had great careers. But Ken was the one who got us started.
Whatever happened to him?
He left us, he married a gal from Louisville. He and Davy Jones of the Monkees became very good friends. And in fact, Davy came to his wedding. And then Ken went to California, went into the haberdashery business with Davy Jones. And as far as I know, he still lives outside of Los Angeles.
Why did he go off of WKLO? Had the whole English-British thing run its course, or he just was ready to move on?
It was beginning to run its course. It seems to me that we decided to part company with Ken, and I really don't remember now why. Most everybody who left the radio station left on their own to go to bigger, better things. Ken didn't. We didn't have a great departure, and I, for the life of me, can't remember why. He left the station. I think the Beatle thing was beginning to taper. He wasn't able to really cross over and do regular disc jockey work. He never did really learn how to do the board and that sort of thing very well. He was a personality, and the personality had pretty much run its course, and he left the radio station. Stayed around Louisville and then got hooked up with Davy Jones, and I think he's had a good life in Marina Del Rey. We had some great disc jockeys. That was probably what made WKLO so good. We were the spawning ground for great disc jockeys. I mentioned Chuck Browning. Chuck left to go to Philadelphia and then to CKLW Detroit, and then I hired him to New York, and after that he had a great career in Los Angeles and San Francisco. Died entirely too young. Charlie Knox was a young guy who I brought in from someplace, I think, in Tennessee, and he was with us for about a year, I guess. Then he went to Denver and then to Houston, and then he went to San Francisco. I think he worked in New York for a while in San Francisco using the name Rick Shaw. And he had a fabulous career, mostly in San Francisco, and he too died entirely too young. Bill Clark, who was the first black guy on a general market radio station in America back before EEO stuff came in, worked at WKLO, went to Washington, D.C., and the last time I heard him, he was the pool announcer for all the networks introducing the President of the United States on all radio and TV networks. Carl Truman Wigglesworth worked at WKLO, followed me as program director, then has had a career of 30-plus years in talk radio as a great talk radio personality in San Antonio. Johnny Randolph has done extremely well. Bill Hennis, who was Wild Willie, has had a great career as a program director in Chicago and Philadelphia and Detroit, a station owner, a consultant. Now he has a country music tip sheet. Jack Sorby left programming and went into sales management and then management. Al Reisen, I think, went to Nashville, maybe back to Louisville. Dale Reeves has had a fabulous career in New York and in doing radio and television comedy network stuff. We had some wonderful talent. I guess that was the main thing about WKLO, is that after we got started, we were able to attract good talent, and then we were able to help them to develop themselves.
What about some of the promotions that you guys did there?
The first promotion that we did, and we did it immediately, I came to the station in August, and we changed the format in September. We probably started this promotion by middle September or the 1st of October. It was called the School Spirit Contest. And it was a simple thing. We asked kids to pass around petitions with WKLO on the top of a piece of paper, and then write their names on the paper. They could sign as many petitions as they wished, but each one only one time. And the school that had the most petitions would win a dance. I think we gave them like a Coca-Cola Hi-Fi Club dance or something like that. Wasn't much. For some reason, it caught on, and I think that was one of the reasons why we became so strong so fast, is we had kids all over town passing around petitions with WKLO on them and, you know, getting our name out. We ended up that first year, I think we had a million or two signatures. We ran it, I think, two more times, and then we got a little bit more sophisticated, and we specified there had to be 25 names to a sheet of paper and all of that, so that we could actually just count the sheets of paper. And the last time we ran it, we had, I don't know, I don't want to exaggerate, but it seems to me we had a total of almost 100 million signatures. The whole basement of the radio station was stacked up in paper. It was so out of hand. All we could do was wave the paper. That got us started. We had Toys for Tots. Shortly after I joined WKLO, a young man who had a band came to me and wanted to put together a dance at the fairgrounds and have a toy for the Marine Corps, Toys for Tots, to get in. And he simply wanted us to promote it and our jocks to MC it. And we talked about it and we agreed to do it, except I said I'd try to find a national act to add to the local bands. And our first Toys for Tots show was in one of the wings, not in Freedom Hall, but one of the wings there. We were hoping for 1,500, 2,000 people. And we had, I think it was 11,000 people show up. And it was just way beyond our dreams and way out of control. I wish I could remember the guy's name, but unfortunately this young man died shortly after that. He had leukemia. He's the fellow who actually inspired us to start Toys for Tots. The next year, we moved it to Freedom Hall, and we had some of the biggest acts that ever came to Louisville. All came there for free. We paid their expenses sometimes, and they presented their own talent. And we would every year have about 40,000 people attend this six-hour marathon of music. It was so big after the second year that we would gather next year's toys this year, so that all the toys that came to this year's show were actually saved for next year. We had so many. In 1967, on Monday morning after our Sunday afternoon show, when the Billboard Hot 100 came out, we had had 5 of the top 10 songs played live on our stage the day before. Plus, Bobby Goldsboro was there as an unknown where he introduced Honey. You know, it was just an incredible show. We always had something called Cash Call, where we put money in the jackpot and then would call people, and they knew the exact amount of money they wanted. And we had Chicken Man. That was one of the first things that we did. We put in the Ork and Chicken Man syndicated series, and after we had done it for a while, Chicken Man dissolved himself some way or another in one of the episodes, and we just, while he was dissolved, said that he had taken the body of somebody in town, and we did a treasure hunt where we asked people to try to find Chicken Man and ask everybody they knew if they were the Chicken Man. And that really created havoc in the community because of the people who were being asked if they were Chicken Man. Butch Beard and Wesley Unsell were playing for the University of Louisville at the time, and I think they were on their way to the NCAA finals or something, and the coach had to call us and say, please, get them off of our guys because they can't practice. They're deluged with questions, are they Chicken Man? One of the judges called and asked the same thing. As a matter of fact, he had somebody from our station in court, and he said he would send them to jail if they didn't get the listeners off of him, all in fun. But those were the kinds of contests we ran. We had lots of contests, but Ernie and I agreed right on, early on, that in order to have a contest, we had to have something that created forced listening, something that would be entertaining, and something that would multiply listenership. So every time we did a contest, we did it with the idea of multiplying listenership and being entertaining.